Hello, everybody. Jam Rutherford here from Self-Reliant Leadership. And with me today is David Ortiz, a very good friend and a fellow veteran. And I want to kick this off by basically having David introduce himself to you and tell you about his story. And we're going to get into really what it means to serve at a quite a deep level. So, David, welcome. And thanks for gracing us with your presence today.
Jan, I feel humbled. I mean, you've had the likes of generals and business leaders here on your show. And so I'm very humbled and proud and excited to be here. Thank you for hosting this.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. So I've heard you tell your story before. And I think it would be great for our audience to kind of know the backstory and how it really has shaped where you're at today with, you know, your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with the of what's going on now and kind of the elevator pitch on what I'm doing here, and then kind of go into the backstory on what led me here. So my name is David Ortiz. I'm running for the Colorado State House here in House District 38, which is Littleton and the western parts of Centennial. I was a combat aviator. I flew Kiowas in the U.S. Army. My dad was Air Force. My grandfather was infantry in World War II. And we all have mottos or mantras that guide us in life, right? One that's motivated my lifetime of service is, I am because we are because I am, or I am, we are for short. And the reason why I love that is because it recognizes how the individual can empower an organization or the community, but also recognizes how the community or an organization can empower the individual. So the short answer for why I decided to run for office is to empower others the way others have empowered me, whether that's through the example of their life, like my grandfather who was infantry in World War II, my dad who was Air Force Academy grad of 79, or my mom who migrated from Mexico when she was only 15 years old. So it was really those values around tenacity, endurance, hard work, selfless service, and the importance of the community that have marked me in my own life. In my own life, I remember-
David, just, you know, say, you said it really quick, that I am, we are. Say a little bit more about that before you dive into the other part, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I mean, so just to give the origins of where that came from, I remember doing a teaching mission in Africa in Tanzania, and we looked for something that would guide the work of service that we were doing, and we wanted something that would kind of encompass about how interconnected we all are and how the individual can impact and shape a community, but also how the community or an organization can impact and shape an individual. And so that's where that came from, and it's kind of stuck with me ever since I was in college throughout. And I think politics, whether you're a community activist, a community leader, whether you're in nonprofit management, whether, you know, even if as a business leader, like you impact the community, and especially if you have employees, you impact their future. It's the same thing as being a platoon sergeant or a platoon leader or a commander. What you do and how you conduct yourself and the example of leadership and how you develop those around you and that are working for you will change and mark the community, and vice versa. The way things are going in the community at large will impact your organization and you as a leader. So really that's where that comes from. I don't know if that's the expansion.
That's great.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the backstory, kind of, you know, your experience in the military and the, you know, the traumatic event that really shaped your life.
Yeah. So for me, what led me there was, you know, my first job after graduating college was resettling evacuees after Hurricane Katrina. And that's an example of the team pulling together. If it wasn't for the business community in Houston offering, you know, free training and prioritized hiring, we wouldn't be able to get it done. I worked for the mayor's office for a while for the city of Houston, creating educational and economic opportunities with companies and universities around the world. But ironically, I got bored of sitting behind a desk and I wanted to serve. I say ironically because your viewers might not be able to see, but I live life in a wheelchair. And I wanted to serve my country in a more intense way. You know, just my family having served for two generations. And I decided to fly helicopters to the Army, got selected for the Warrant Officer Program. And I loved it. I mean, from my nickel ride, the first time you pick up in a helicopter, it was just like a permagrin on my face. And the amazing men and women that you get to train with. And just the mission and the idea of team and family that comes with that and everything that you go through together, whether you're talking about training stateside or being on deployment, is very special and very unique. You know, fast forward to deployment, you know, we're in Afghanistan. It was 9 months into my deployment. We went out for a mission and we were coming back for rearm and refuel and we got indications that our engine was having an issue. So we assumed an auto rotative profile, which means we're getting ready for an emergency landing. We're about 2 or 3 miles from the FOB, from the base. And then things went from bad to worse. So we initiated the emergency landing and on the way down, the engine exploded. And that's when I knew it wasn't a test. And I knew it was the engine exploding and not from any outside fire because the nose yawed and just the profile and the way the helicopter was flying. So my memory cuts out about 20 feet from the ground. And my last thought was thinking that we were coming in a little bit too fast. And all of a sudden I wake up with metal weighted on my body, covering me, dust thick and heavy in the air. I'm having a hard time breathing. And I wake up to the sounds of my sister ship landing. We always fly in teams of two. And their job, if they can't get you on the radio, is to check for signs of life. So they land and the co-pilot gets out who, you know, I was around flight school and walk school around the same time. We weren't in the same class. We were around each other from Texas originally as well. My family's from Texas originally. And I see his mustache through all the debris. And I hear him yell, "Ortiz, are you live down there?" So with as much energy as I could muster, I was like, "Yeah, get me out of here." So he started ripping all the metal from on top of me. And it got down to the wiring that they needed like special cutters for. And all of a sudden he grabs a bunch of gauze from his first aid kit. I don't know if there's a little scar down here, but he grabs a bunch of gauze and was like, pushes whatever was coming out back in there. And he was like, "Here, hold this." So I'm like holding this. I remember being so thirsty, asking for water. And I look down and I see that my feet are 90 degrees perpendicular to my shin bone, as if I tried to Fred Flintstone stop that helicopter, but I couldn't feel it. So I knew I was in a bad way. I mean, I had fractured ribs, a collapsed right lung, which is why I was having a hard time breathing, as well as having a cut in the bottom of my throat, lacerations on the top of my skull. We were lucky though, medevac happened to be in the AO. And so they were there within 3 to 5 minutes after that. So the medic got there, freed me from all the rest of the wiring and the debris. And the last memory I have was like laying back in the medevac all the way, like not putting my head up and laying back. And I guess I let go of the gauze because then I heard my medic say something you never want to hear your medic say. I heard him be like, "Oh, expletive." And I was like, I started to freak out. I was like, "What's going on? What's wrong?" And he's like, "No, you're fine. Just a wound that I didn't see. You're going to be fine." And that was the last time I had consciousness. And I was unconscious from Salerno to Bagram. And then, you know, one of my mentors that was flying out of Bagram was with me the whole time, unbeknownst to me. And then I was in Monstuhl, and when you're in a medically induced coma, you have really strange dreams. And it was one of those things where I wasn't even sure if the crash was real or a dream, but the nurses didn't know if I was going to make it, because you know what they do, they call your parents and put the phone to your ear just in case. And so they did that. But then like in my dream, I found a doorway and opened it up. And sure enough, I woke up to my parents' voices with the phone pressed against my ear. And that's when I knew it was real. And I was intubated and I was fighting for them to get that out of there. And they pulled the tubing out of there, go from Launchstuhl to Walter Reed, try to pass away on them twice, I guess. I always say that the devil was scared of me and God didn't want me or wasn't ready for me yet. But that's when I knew my life has changed. You know, when I get to Walter Reed, go into emergent care, emergent surgery, when you go from being a hard charging aviator that's running 5 and 10 Ks at 5.5 minute miles, you know, overachieving, to not being able to sit up in bed under your own power, it's a life changer, for sure. And if it wasn't for the community that rallied around me, whether it was my, you know, brother and sister service members that on their R&R decided to visit me, you know, I wouldn't have been able to be in the right headspace to recover. Particularly, I got to give a shout out to a past brother of mine, Jose Montenegro, who came to visit me on his R&R with his family, and he tried to make me make a promise. He was like, "You're too smart. You're one of the smartest ones of us. You know policy. You know, you're here for a reason. You have to promise me that you're going to get on your feet and that you're going to keep serving this country in the ways that I know that you can." And I wasn't ready to hear it. I wasn't. So I just ignored it. We now joked around. Sure enough, though, he goes back to deployment and he bothers me every once in a while on Facebook. We chat and he every once in a while that promise pops up. And, you know, August comes up and it's a month before everyone's supposed to come home. So I was like, fine, because I know he's going to get in my face if I don't make the promise. Plus, I was in a better place by that time. And then fast forward to the 5th of September, I wake up and my phone has blown up. You know, the Kiowa went down. And your first question as a pilot is, who was it? Because you want to know who it was, you know, someone that you knew personally or not. And sure enough, it was Jose's aircraft with another mutual friend of ours, Talia Ramirez, and they both passed away. It was a week before everybody was supposed to come home. And I remember getting in contact with his family and friends, and they said that he was, you know, Talia was going to be buried in Arlington, but Jose was going to be buried at a veteran cemetery in Harlingen, and I was at the spinal cord injury unit in San Antonio at the time. And, you know, I remember telling the doctors, well, I'm going to go to the funeral. And I still had like wounds that were healing and stuff like that. And the docs were like, well, we don't think you're stable enough to go. And I was like, you don't know me. I'm not asking for permission. I'm telling you I'm going. What I'm asking is to help me not make this worse. So then when I go and I see a mentor and a friend that had so much love in his heart and so much compassion, but so much fight and so much life in a box, and I see the way that it impacted his family, that was it. Like all of the feeling sorry for myself, all of the, you know, the situation was gone, and I rededicated myself to that promise. So fought to come to Craig Hospital, which is one of the best spinal cord rehab hospitals in the US. And it was a fight, I'm not gonna lie. Like, the Warrior Transition Battalion tried to create a case against me, chalking it up to undiagnosed PTS or untreated PTS and mental health issues. You know, and I ended up going to my elected leaders in the media to fight for the care that I know that I'd earned. And so my battalion commander, my battalion surgeon got replaced. And within a month, I was at Craig Hospital, and that's when my life changed. That's when I regained my independence, became active again. You know, I downhill ski, I cross country ski, I mountain bike, I kayak, I camp. Being active was an important part of me getting my life back. Then I started, you know, my battalion commander at the Warrior Transit Battalion in Fort Carson was like, hey, there's this veterans lobby group. You're outgoing and you got a big mouth. Why don't you put it to good use and start lobbying and advocating for veterans? So I did at the state capitol, and, you know, at first I was an intern, so, you know, I only was, you know, charged with like small bills or helping out on ballot initiatives. And then in 2017, my mentor, Bill Hanna, who is an amazing listener, I wish more people were like him, was like, you're my retirement plan. So now you're the lead lobbyist in 2017. Now go do. So, you know, we got a lot of great work done around criminal justice reform, supporting veteran treatment courts. And for those that aren't familiar, it's, for veterans that, commit a nonviolent crime that can be traced back to undiagnosed or untreated PTS or mental health issues. Claim guilty, but they go immediately on probation. And if they meet certain gates, then they get to stay on probation and get reintegrated into society. And it has like over a 75% success rate. We also got a higher education reform bill passed that mandated that Colorado higher ed institutions grant meaningful credit for military education and training. So before, let's say you had a female veteran that had 10 years of COM OIT experience, CU was only granting 3 hours of elective physical education credit for all of that training and knowledge and experience. After this bill was passed, a year after, PBS NewsHour did a story on it, and veterans and service members, so current people that are currently in, are getting 20 to 30 credit hours towards a degree of study. So I love the work that I was doing there. I still did nonprofit work with, you know, I was program director of Veterans of Foreign Wars Post One. I was also on the field advisory committee of the Paralyzed Veterans of America. You know, shout out to them. There it is. And we inspect spinal cord injury units at VAs across the country, you know, maintaining a certain standard of care. And then at one of these legislative forums, there was a whole bunch of state legislators and federal offices there. And State Senator Patterson was like, hey, have you ever considered running for office? And I was 37 at the time. And I was like, nah, I'm good. You know, I really love the nonprofit work I'm doing. And she's like, but look at all the people you bring together and look at your story and look how you still serve. We need people like you in office. And so she was like, talk to the people here in your community, talk to the important people in my life. And I did, and it was an overwhelming, yes, we need people like you. You can speak to making healthcare a right that others can't, so.
Do you think if you hadn't been asked that question that you wouldn't have pursued that path, or was there a spark there?
I mean, I always considered it, but like I was very skeptical and I always had very high bars. Like the community has to ask me to serve. Like they're going to have to want me because I wasn't going to subject myself. And like part of it too is like consent matters, right? Like I'm not going to force myself on a community that doesn't want me. Like I love the work that I'm doing for veterans and those living with a disability. You know, if the community wants me, they'll ask me. That was kind of the requirement. And so it was almost like I was afraid and I was sitting and waiting, you know, and plus like, I didn't know what it would mean to run for office, living life in a wheelchair, because I mean, people see representations of us like Professor X and they see me show up and they see me, you know, dressed in a suit and buttoned up and they think, you know, like I get dressed like everyone else. No, that's not how it goes. This life impacts every aspect of your life, how you shower, how you use a restroom, how you get ready in the morning, like how you get in and out of your car. So doing this has been intense. I mean, it's kind of stepped up my game and I was afraid to, I'll be honest, I was a little afraid to until I saw, you know, Chris Hines run for Denver City Council, who is also a wheelchair user, and kind of the way he navigated that and seeing him being able to do it kind of helped me push me towards yes.
Have you ever met Tammy Duckworth?
No, I've never had the privilege of getting to meet her yet.
So. But I mean, is that somebody that you can relate to? And for the listeners, I mean, somebody that serves in Congress and helicopter pilot that lost her legs, wheelchair bound.
Definitely. I mean, I look up to her a lot. I do follow her on Twitter and I'll retweet her stuff. A lot of my mentors and staffers around me are like, oh, you got to create your own content, which I do. But like, I also want to give credit. If someone said something awesomely and amazingly, like I'm going to give them credit. She's definitely someone I look up to and that's a great public servant. So
let me, there's a lot that I want to get to. And the first question I had is, you know, you said, I got the treatment I earned. You didn't use the word deserve. You said I earned, and people out there might be surprised a veteran had to fight for that. What other needs are unmet for our today's veterans that you see out there?
So I think we all come at a certain problem with our own perspective, right? And I think that one of the biggest needs that I see in the veteran space is transition. And that's where because think about it, our country spends, and you know this, our country spends so much time and money training us and giving us skills and leadership and how to manage stress and stressful situations and multitasking and being mission focused and putting our differences aside and whatever, like whatever specific training you have on top of the general skills that you get from being in the military. But then you have brother and sister veterans that are transitioning out and don't understand the value of the skills they have. I mean, some of them, and I've heard this, like all I was a door kicker. And I was like, no, that's not all you were. You were also a manager. You know, depending on what, you know, rank and position you had, you manage personnel and staff, you manage their development. You can talk about how many hours you put into that. And like, there's a lot of different ways to measure that in civilian speak so that your resume can resonate with civilians. And a lot of them don't understand how to do that. And full disclosure, I mean, we met during a nonprofit veteran program called Valor Bridge. That's like a mini MBA or networking program whose job it is to kind of help the veteran identify their skills and help connect them into a network that's going to help them transition to a professional job, you know, utilizing those skills. And I think that's the biggest need. I mean, that's where you see a lot of, if service members within that year or two window don't find their purpose and meaning after service, because think about it, we get in some pretty intense situations. We get trusted with immense responsibility, you know, multi-million dollar pieces of equipment, other lives. And then we go into the civilian world from a team atmosphere where we're expected to find our own way. It can be a rough transition for people. I mean, you're dealing with the loss of that team or that family. You're dealing with the loss of that intense meaning and purpose. And then you're plopped into the civilian world. And we have about a year or two to empower our brother and sister veterans and help them find their path and their purpose and their meaning again. Because otherwise, that's when people turn to drugs and alcohol. That's when people get into like DUIs or behavioral health issues. It's easy to slide downhill. I mean, you're aware. So yeah. I think that's the biggest need. I mean, we do have healthcare needs, but.
Yeah. Well, Wayne Wenton, who just retired as a master sergeant, U.S. Army, was on a crucible with us recently, an expedition out in the Colorado mountains. And he's asking, was there any time you felt down and defeated and just wanted to quit? If so, what helped you through that?
Let's be vulnerable. The day that my close friends passed away was a rough day for me. Another day that was, I mean, and what brought me past that was the fact that, like, I don't know, it was seeing the way it impacted his family and realizing that I had that second chance that he and she did not get. And that it's my responsibility to stop feeling sorry for myself and make the most of it now. That I it's almost like that cliche, cheesy Private Ryan thing. Like, I get to be here and they don't, and I have to make my life count now because they were amazing humans and now we're lesser for them not being here. So that was a part of it. I remember there being another day when, you know, again, going back to the Warrior Transition Battalion under old leadership in San Antonio was building a case against me because I was making things hard for them. I was demanding the care that I'd earned. And whenever you ask people that are above you, whenever you demand accountability, like if they're not true leaders, people could get insecure and give a lot of pushback on that. And that's the route they were choosing to go, doing counseling statements and trying to build a case against me. And there was, I mean, I was at the Fisher House, it was 1 o'clock in the morning and I was almost in tears because I was like, this is my life and I've got a second chance that I'm fighting for. And the people that are supposed to empower me are in my way. They're working against me. So what do I do? Either I do like the yes sir, yes ma'am and just drive on, or I fight for myself and for others too. Because here's the thing, the military doesn't have anything organic for brain injury or spinal cord injury. And their go-to, because it's the most cost-effective, is to farm you out to VAs. And one, not all VA spinal cord injury units are created equal. And compared to like places like Craig Hospital, it's just not the same caliber of care, especially when you're young and motivated. I mean, it was my main care physician at the spinal cord injury unit VA that said, you don't belong here. You're too young, you're too strong, you're too motivated. So I fought for myself. I turned to the media, but like there's always consequences when you go outside of the chain of command, right? I mean, look what happened to that admiral on that ship during a time of COVID-19. Like, and you have to be ready to own that as a leader. When you're fighting for yourself and for others that are going through the same thing you are, you have to be ready to take the consequences. And it was that moment and that decision of agony, you know what I mean? And there are other bad days. I mean, when you live with this injury, you know, you don't have control over your body the way you used to. So what used to take you 5 or 10 minutes to use the restroom and shower can now take 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So really reflect on that. So like in order to make a 7 a.m. hard time, I'm waking up at 4 in the morning. And it might only take me 30 minutes and then I'll do some work, but then it might take the full 2 hours. And, you know, that's just the way you live life. So I don't know. A lot of my struggles were tied to when the Warrior Transition Battalion felt like they were fighting against me more than helping my recovery. Mm-hmm. There's been less harder days after I was medically retired out of the military. But to say that there aren't hard days would be a lie. I mean, yesterday was a hard day. When you see videos of like little girls, you know, of color, and a little boy of color and a black woman of color being put on the pavement by APD at gunpoint, like, God, I had so many friends of color that passed away in service and like I sacrificed half my body for it. This isn't the America that I fought for. And we've been dealing with this for forever. Like, it is 2020 and we're still dealing with this. So, you know, I have moments like that that really hurt and crushed me. I mean, after you sacrifice so much for this nation, you want it to be better. You want to be proud of it. When you see videos of that in your home, it hurts. So
I saw that. You know, oftentimes they'll say, hey, you know, the video you're about to see is disturbing. That to me hit me viscerally, you know, seeing that family and those kids screaming. That was really tough to watch. Wayne says thank you for your answer. And you know, a lot of what you've used the word is serve. And you know, when we had Martin Dempsey on, we asked him about transitioning, and General Dempsey said that, you know, hey, you were proud of what you did before, you know, whatever you choose to do in the future, make sure it's something you're proud of. And I thought that was really good advice. You know, when it comes to you and, you know, why you continue to serve, what is it that you think drives you, you know, to, because it sounds like, David, like, you know, that there's a part of you that wants to fight for the underdog, that's always been there and it's still there. Is that, would I be reading that right?
Yeah. I mean, I mean, absolutely true. I'm reflecting a little bit on that question, because it is absolutely true. I mean, you're talking about somebody who has family that they're still connected to in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not that we don't have problems here in our own country, but like at any given time, any journalist in Mexico can be murdered. You want to talk, people talk like complain about the government here being corrupt and like we have our own issues to deal with. I'm not trying to soften that blow, but like you want to look at corruption, mm-hmm. go to a place like Mexico. So I understand the privilege that I have in being here. And especially when my mom migrated, you know, from Mexico back in the late 70s, early 80s, like I always think of there, but for the grace of God go I, right? Like if she were to try to migrate, her and her family were to try and migrate from Mexico now and they got picked up, they'd be separated. And the younger kids would be put in cages. You know what I mean? And it's that understanding of the privilege that you truly have and how lucky that you are and the blessings that you have because of where you're at. And let's be honest, like, even though we do have our own problems, we have the blessings to fight to fix things. Like, I can speak out against policies and not end up in jail or murdered. You know, I mean, well, minus what's going on with some of the federal police in certain states, right, that we're seeing lately. But, you know, we have that opportunity here, and that's not lost in me. So I always feel compelled to fight for the underrepresented, the marginalized, and the underdog. And not to say that I haven't been there too. Like, I felt like the underdog when I was fighting for my care. I mean, here I have captains and colonels and majors that are trying to build a case against me. That's pretty overwhelming. You feel pretty defeated when that's happening, but you can't give up. Like, that's, I think that's what marks the difference, in my opinion, between a truly successful leader in the community versus someone that's not, because you're always going to have setbacks in life, professionally, personally, but it's how you overcome them, how you learn from them, and how you continue to endure to fight for the things that you believe in that differentiates true leaders that make change versus those that don't. So
before we went live, we had a brief discussion about how a lot of veterans are, you know, consider themselves moderate, you know, politically. Yeah. And you chose the Democratic Party. I'm wondering how you went about that. I mean, is it a lot of how your life's been in, you know, the experiences you've had, you know, where you've come from, sort of the things you just referenced? And were you worried at all that, boy, if I choose sides, you know, there's going to be half the people are with me and half the people are against me? I mean, did you ever think about going right down the middle and saying I'm an independent?
When it comes to running for office as an independent, no. Because I'm going to be real pragmatic and realistic, is there is support on both sides that comes with choosing a side. And so, you know, to be honest, like, the platform of the Democrats speaks to me more, especially right now, more than ever. That being said, was I worried about picking a side? I mean, having been an advocate and lobbyist, I was so careful to not, because I didn't want to impact the way that veterans were going to be treated or represented. I mean, all of my bills at the state capitol were bipartisan. I know how to reach across the aisle. And at the end of the day, part of the reason why I loved my service in the military is because we get to serve with all kinds of people. Like, that can be good and bad, right? But for the most part, I found it a good, because, like, I have so much love for people that are conservative. They're brothers no matter what. And I check in with them every once in a while. And we know what issues we're not going to agree on, but we always come to an area that we can agree on. For example, like, we start with choice, you know, the woman's right to choose what happens to her body. And, like, you know, a friend's not going to agree with that. But then we talk about, like, adoption and foster care. And he's been a foster parent for three different kids and ended up adopting one. And he has identified issues in the process where he wants to make it easier without compromising the safety of the kids. And, like, that's an example of what I love about this country and what we should be. That being said, you know, what I'm seeing now, I feel like I have no choice but to be a Democrat right now. Like, if you just want to talk small government and low taxes, fine, we can debate that all day. And I would be sly and say, I'm for small government too. I'm for efficient government, because there's always going to be needs out there that need to be met. But, you know, with what we're seeing with racial inequity and fighting for racial justice, what we see with the court cases that are coming before the Supreme Court on how we treat our LGBTQ siblings, it's a no-brainer. And the fact that, like, the way I was raised, and this, I come from a Reagan conservative family. You have to understand that too. I mean, my dad might have originally been a Democrat. He was a Bob Kennedy supporter. And I mean, he remembers the night when he got assassinated, and he was a Carter supporter. But after Reagan, he's been what I would consider a true conservative. Like, he is small taxes, you know, small government, has not voted for Trump. Sorry to out you, Dad. I love you, though. We'll never vote for this president. But, you know, it's I mean, I remember my parents sitting me down at 7 years old and saying, okay, we're going to watch a film with you, and this is to teach you how people will use your religion, the color of your skin, to judge who you are. And it was Schindler's List. So imagine, as a 7 year old, watching systematic dehumanization of a group simply for what their religion is, as a kid, and seeing them stripped down naked and all the scenes in that movie. And my parents have always been big on social justice, and that's always marked me moving forward, you know. And so I know social programs can work. We shouldn't be afraid of social programs. I mean, the fact that I'm here and empowered and active and I'm living independently in my own home speaks to the testament of social programs. We're not asking for a handout. We're asking for fighting for equity and opportunities. Your access to opportunities should not be dictated by your socioeconomic level or your zip code. And I think you know, I think most Americans would agree with that. And, yeah. you know, we live in an environment that tries to hyper-partisan everything, but, you know.
Here's that's John that's Hunt. Yeah, a conservative that says you're still a good person.
So he's who I'm talking about. When I tell that story, that's specifically yeah. him. You know, I have a lot of love and respect for John Hunt, and I always check in with him every once in a while to make sure I'm not drinking too deeply of the Kool-Aid, as I put it.
And Shaola Schneck said she had to drop off, but keep inspiring us with Shaola. The good fight. So another question, David, is, you know, the whole idea of politics we talk about these days is we'd love to see more compromise from both sides. And it starts with really seeing the other person's point of view. And at the beginning of our discussion today, I was talking about the book by Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind, and, you know, really understanding, you know, that most of us are pretty self-righteous. You know, that's yeah. a little bit of human nature, and we can't understand somebody else's point of view. What have you learned about that from your military service and running for office, about what it really means to see somebody else's point of view that's vastly different rather than completely digging in your heels?
So I'll say the three people that taught me most about being a good listener in my life are going to be my younger brother, Michael. And he was with me for a part of my recovery. He was my Samwise Gamgee for all you Lord of the Ring nerds out there. My fiance, Kate, who's just a giant heart and super empathetic. And then my mentor, Bill Hanna, who was a lobbyist and advocate for the Department of Health and Human Services, specifically for marginalized communities. During the Vietnam era, he was in divinity school. So he always felt this guilt at not serving. So he was actually the lead lobbyist for veterans, this veteran organization that I eventually worked for pennies, just because he wanted to serve veterans, he wanted to work for veterans. And he taught me more about listening than anyone in my life. And I will say this, shout out to Bill, if more people like him existed, this world would be a better place. But in order to truly understand the heart of people's frustrations, I think you have to start with listening. So here's an example of a policy that I'll go to, is like this anti-growth movement. Well, where does it really come from? It's not, for the most part, it's not that people hate their fellow human or don't want to be around their fellow human. It's the fact that now their kids' classrooms has 40 or 50 students, when really they want their kids to have that best access to education with a classroom size of 20 to 30. You know what I mean? They're sitting in traffic. What used to take them 15 minutes to get to work now takes 45 minutes to an hour. So really, I think the heart of, when it comes to listening to their frustrations, the heart is identifying, well, what's at the heart of it? And it's the infrastructure is not meeting the demands of the influx of people that we have. Well, how do we do that? And you know, then it goes to paying for these programs, and then you get frustrations around taxes. And it's like, well, you know, those that have benefited the most from the society that we live in, whether it's business leaders, big companies, whatever, should be shouldering most of the burden. I don't think that's unfair to ask of that. Those that have benefited the most should pay the most. And it behooves them, because if we have the best education system in the world, then they have the best pool of applicants for employees to draw from. Like, I feel like it is a system that's so interconnected and circular, and we need to start viewing it that way.
Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. And I often ask this question on our podcast. One thing I haven't heard much of in the discussion is anything on personal responsibility. You know, that just seems to be missing from the conversation. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I come from a very, you know, conservative, hardworking family. So, you know, that's always been ingrained in me. I mean, part of the reason why I've been able to rebuild my life and regain my independence so quick was because even though I'm working within a system that's not helping me out, it's still my responsibility to live the best life that I can at the end of the day. That's what mm-hmm. I view it as. And I don't just represent myself. Like, I still feel like I represent Alpha Troop 117. I represent the CAV. Like, this is my history. So the better I do, the better I reflect on them. And that's an aspect of it. And I feel like we need to cultivate that as individuals still in this country, is that you belong to one of the best countries in the world, our current problems notwithstanding. It's your job to do everything you can, not just to make things better for yourself, but everyone that comes after you. That, to me, that's what personal responsibility means. It's not just personal for you, because I even saw that in recovery. Were there other spinal cord injuries that went through the Warrior Transition Battalions? Of course there were. But what I noticed was that they fought for themselves, and then once their fight was over, that was it. And that's not enough in my mind. When you get the benefits that this country affords you, the freedoms and the opportunities, not that we don't have a long way to go, but it's your duty and your responsibility to make sure other Americans have the opportunity to make the most of themselves too. That's what true leaders do, in my opinion. It's not just about how well you can do, it's how well those people coming after you do. So yeah, there's, I mean, personal responsibility is always intertwined with what I'm doing, but you never know. Like, there's an alternate universe where David Ortiz never got off the painkillers from his injury and ended up on, you know, addicted to opioids and ended up a homeless veteran. And could I be blamed? I mean, to an extent, yeah, I guess I could, but like, is that fair to put all the blame on me? Like, when we send our young men and women to combat, we are letting some fall through the cracks in how we treat opioid addiction and how we treat mental health care issues. Like, I mean, that's up for a personal debate. I invite every viewer and every American to really challenge themselves and look within to themselves and see if they can have a little bit of compassion and understanding when it comes to how people can find themselves in negative scenarios. And what personal responsibility do we have then to making sure we make better opportunities for our fellow American?
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, you know, we've heard from people like General Stan McChrystal talk about national service. Do you know, there's all this talk about stimulus checks and different things. And I've heard some people say, you know, gosh, why aren't we, rather than just giving away free money, why aren't we actually, you know, doing some things with regard to infrastructure and social programs and things like that? Any, you know, again, it's way beyond being a state legislator to start with, but, you know, any thoughts on national service?
Oh, like whether I want to do national service?
Yeah, I mean, whether you think
or
that,
in general.
You know, whether you think that's something that's missing from, you know, making this country better than it is today.
I would love to see that. Like, not just, and it doesn't necessarily have to be military. It could be Volunteers of America. It could be, you know, Teach for America. It'd be all these programs. Like, but having a pathway of service that's government funded, like, because I'll speak to my, like, and you can speak to your experience in the military, but for me, it really taught me to have such a love of like the ideals in the Constitution and feel like I belong to this country and not any one place in this country. And yeah, I have tribes, but ultimately my ultimate allegiance, like, is to my American family, bottom line. And I think that idea of service and stripping down some of your, in, you know, your individuality and giving of yourself to a greater cause in service to the nation cultivates that attitude, in my opinion. I think it does. So if we had other ways to serve that weren't necessarily only military or combat related, so that could speak to the different callings that people might have, I think that would go a long way into getting rid of some of the divisiveness and bringing us together as a nation and, you know, securing some early training and professional skills that others can take for the rest of their life. Absolutely.
Yeah. One of my mentors who happened to have served as well used to always ask me, for whose good do you serve? And I found myself asking that of veterans that are transitioning. Is, you know, oftentimes they'll think, I've got to, you know, go to some cool, sexy tech company on the West Coast, you know, to make it. And I'm like, well, let's start with your values. Let's start with your people. I mean, the people that you have a passion for, the people that you think you can help the most. And that could be industry specific. But I mean, just like people are drawn to certain charities and certain churches and different things, is to really figure out, you know, for whose good do you serve? David, what's your hope?
In life, in the world? I mean, the short answer to that is, you know, my hope in serving in HD 38 is to, I mean, it's multifaceted. One is, I think we need more veterans that get elected to office, so that are involved in politics, whether they want to be lobbyists, advocates, campaign manager, field directors, or elected leaders. There's something unique about military service, even if you ascribe to a specific party, where you understand how to put your differences aside and work with and love your fellow American. I might not always love everything about you. I might not always like you on any given day. And I can say that about some people in my troop that I served with. I'm sure they could say that about me, but we always loved each other, if that makes sense. We're always family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an attitude that a lot of veterans bring to the table. So that's why I have a personal like hope that more veterans serve. You know, being a person with a disability living in a wheelchair, it's always been to show what I'm capable of. I mean, one of my first interactions with an elected leader, and I'm close with him now, so I don't want to out his name, was he looks at me as we're waiting across the street and he's like, "What'd you do to yourself?" Like, that was his first question. That was his assumption. Like, what did you do to yourself? And as soon as I told him my story, I mean, he was, you know, he was a brother veteran, like it became okay. But like, why, when you look at someone that lives with a disability, like that's your first question? You know, so it's also about breaking stereotypes. You know, that's why I was proud to be the first person to do research work on dive work on the USS Arizona. I was the first paraplegic to ever do research dive work on the USS Arizona. And if I get elected, I'll be the first wheelchair user to ever get elected to the Colorado State Legislature. They'll have to make renovations to the Colorado State House, Senate, and to the building as a whole to make it truly accessible, because right now it's not. So, you know, I think I bring an experience and a background of having worked, you know, with both parties, of still having my values, and I'll be true to my values no matter what, but in viewing us as the same American family. And that's my hope, is I understand we have our values, and there's certain red lines that are non-negotiable for me. Like, saying Black Lives Matter should not be a partisan thing. Supporting racial equity and justice should not be partisan. You know, fighting to combat climate change should be a partisan issue. I mean, I get concerned as someone that served in the military when I see that China is monopolizing all the supply chains for raw materials for renewable energy platforms. And if you as an American aren't concerned about that too, then you're focused on the wrong things. Like, climate change shouldn't be a partisan issue. Gun safety legislation shouldn't be a partisan issue. I mean, we had Sheriff Spurlock in Highlands Ranch, who's a Republican sheriff, promoting the red flag law and giving data and facts on why it works and why it makes his job easier and why it saves lives. So it's about protecting responsible gun owners. I mean, we have safe storage laws in states like Texas. You know what I mean? So it's about trying to move away from villainizing each other and really focusing on solving problems for our country and making this the best place to live, to where your socioeconomic level or your zip code should not dictate, you know, your access to opportunities. And I'm not trying to punish success either. I'm not saying everyone needs to make the same amount of money. What I am saying is, as a business leader, as a job creator, as someone that has benefited so much from the amazing things that this country has to offer, try and be more empathetic and try and listen more and try and relate to the everyday struggles of people you might not be connected to anymore. Just try.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Finding common ground. So as we wrap up today, David, again, thank you for agreeing to get on and share your story. It's a moving story. What challenge might you have for the people that are viewing and listening?
So I'm going to echo the words of Congressman Joe Neguse, because I was the first time I got the opportunity to meet him in person. It was right going into Thanksgiving, and I really appreciated what he had to say, because he didn't make any allowances for failure in leadership, you know, in his attack of certain elected leaders. But then he followed it up with this: you know, we're about to go to Thanksgiving, and what this country needs more of is more empathy, more compassion, more bridge building. So when you go back to your families, to your friends for Thanksgiving, try and listen, try and talk to them, try and build that bridge. I'm not saying compromise your values, but what I am saying is try and build a relationship with people that view things completely opposite of you. And I know that's a big ask, because I know I'll be honest with you, Jan, like in a time of 2020 with everything that's going on, I have cut out certain friends from my life. Because again, this goes back to red lines. Like, if you're saying Black Lives Matter, but then we're not friends anymore. We can't be. Like, we're not there yet. Once we get past this, maybe we can be friends in the future. But the call of the better angels of our nature is really try and have empathy and have compassion for the person that has mental health issues. You don't know what that's like, or that might be addicted to opioids, especially those that are dealing with mental health issues. You don't know what that's like, or that might be addicted to alcohol. Like, you don't know what that's like. And think about what we can do to try and solve those problems, not like as a handout. Stop viewing it as that. Try and view it as a way to really get at the heart of the problem, to help empower them so they can make the most out of their life and be a fellow citizen that lifts us all up, right? All boats rise and fall by the same tide. And what are you doing to inspire the best in your fellow American and your fellow citizen to help empower each other? That's my ask. That's my challenge, is what are you doing in a positive way to empower others and to challenge each other to bring out the best in each other? Because there's so much out there that's bringing out the worst in us. There is. So.
Well said, well stated. Well, again, I wish you luck in the final days of the campaign, and we'll look to see how it turns out. Hopefully it will be on that day, not a week or a month later.
Yeah, we'll see. For anybody that wants to find out more about my past service, bills I've worked on, or what this campaign is about, you can go to my website. It's going to be www.davidortiz, that's O-R-T-I-Z, colorado.com. And even if you don't live in my district, let me tell you, every dollar contributed is going to matter. And this goes to things like paying for like great staff, my campaign manager, who is making more than I am right now, and as a legislator, by the way. But that's, I mean, if you're going to talk about livable wages, you got to provide them, but also directly talking to voters about the issues. And let's work together to get more veterans elected, to get more people of compassion and that want to lead with service elected. So I'll leave you with that. Go to davidortizcolorado.com.
Yeah. And Wayne chimed in again, as a few others did, and thank you for being vulnerable and sharing your struggles. You know, a lot of folks out there in the veteran community, the transition is not weeks and months, but sometimes years. So thank you, and we wish you luck.
Thank you, guys. Be in touch. Stay tuned. Right. Thank you.